Thank you very much. Also, thanks to the organizers for the kind invitation to present on behalf of the PLC collaboration our view of the highest energy particles in the universe. Now, for the cosmic ray community, where I'm coming from, this is a very special year because it's our 100th anniversary. 100 years ago, cosmic rays were discovered. And for that reason, I will also give sort of a short historical introduction to the topic. Then we come to the PLG Observatory and have a look at some results and outlook. Let us start by having a look to the observational windows to the universe, so to the outer space, where we have basically three different classes of messengers to the universe, the photons or light, the classical cosmic rays, and the neutrinos. And this spectrum here symbolizes the energy range, ranging from photons, from radio, up to highest energies. Now, starting with the photons, the deep exploration of the universe by photons started about 400 years ago with the invention of the telescope in the optical regime. But by now, it covers an impressive range from radio wavelengths up to energies of about 100 TeV, 10 to 14 electron volts. This is, for instance, yesterday the talk we heard about S atmospheric Cherenkov telescopes. They observe photons up to 100 TeV. The charged cosmic rays, this started 100 years ago, and cosmic rays are observed from below GeV region up to 10 to 20 electron volts and more. And neutrinos started about 40 years ago. Neutrinos from the universe are present in MeV range, solar neutrinos and supernova 87. Now, looking back into history, one can learn something, because always when a new window to the universe was opened, or if a significantly deeper look could be taken into that wavelength range, new discoveries were made. Some examples are listed here, for instance, the cosmic microwave background in the photons, or the gamma ray burst discovery in the photons. From the charged cosmic rays and the air showers, they initiated muons were discovered, also positrons or the pions. And in the neutrino sector, oscillations were discovered as a new unexpected phenomenon. And in fact, these discoveries often enough were not predicted at all. This is something that funding agencies should keep in mind to maybe want quarterly milestones or so when you apply for funding. Often enough, the best comes completely unexpected, and one should be open-minded to these things. And another feature, these different discoveries had impact on quite different fields of physics, not just astrophysics, but also particle physics, cosmology, and fundamental physics. Okay, I will focus on the Pierre-Auger Observatory. We are observing cosmic rays using air showers above 1 EeV, this is 10 to 18 electron volts. This will be the main focus. We are also searching with the Auger Observatory for photons and neutrinos at ultra high energy. I will also say a few words in particular about the search for photons. Now let us jump back 100 years. As I said, cosmic rays were discovered 100 years ago. That was in a seminal balloon flight by Victor Hess, a French Austrian physicist, who was flying more than 200 kilometers and landing close to Berlin. He reached a record altitude at the time of about 5,000 meters. This was quite an adventure at that time. And what he was measuring with electroscopes is the ionization of air. It was an unsolved puzzle at the time why the air is ionized. Ideas were this is due to radioactivity from the Earth. Okay, if that is the explanation, you should go up to high altitude and the ionization should be reduced. But Hess observed this is not the case. Around 5,000 meters, there's even a strong increase in the ionization of air. And this then marks the discovery of cosmic rays, or better, Höhenstrahlung, as it was initially termed. when you jump to the year 38, where air showers were discovered, extensive air showers by Pierre Auger, also others like Kohlhörster, they realized that often particles arrive coincidentally on ground. So not disconnected, completely arbitrary, but as if they arrive in a pancake on ground. And they correctly concluded that they have a common origin, that they must be due to one very high energy primary particle. So this is the discovery of air showers. If you want, the primary particle enters the atmosphere, creates a particle cascade, and at ground you observe the secondary particle. And in fact, these air showers are still our basic tool to observe cosmic rays at various energies. If you estimate what was the energy of the primary particle that OJ was observing, the air showers, then this is in the PeV region, 10 to 15 electron volts, so already very impressive energy at that time. Okay, this energy was shifted towards higher and higher values in the early 60s, in particular Lindsley, a pioneer of the field, installed 20 detectors, 20 scintillator stations over an area of 2 square kilometers, and was measuring these air showers. Here you can see him approaching carefully to one of his detectors, because he had to check for rattlesnakes when looking if it was still working. And what he observed is that from time to time, not very often, one of these 20 detectors had coincidentally a signal. And if you then deduce, try to deduce the primary energy of that, then he estimated this must have been a primary particle of 10 to 19 electron volts or even higher. So the energy frontier was shifted to higher and higher energies. This was in the early 60s, when in 65, Penzias and Wilson discovered the cosmic microwave background. So a radiation that fills the whole universe. And quickly Greisen and independently Zazepin and Kusmin realized that this is of quite some importance for the propagation of particles at higher and higher energies due to the famous GZK process that is shown here. Imagine you have a proton of at least 50 eV, 5 × 10⁻⁹ electron volt. When this can interact with this cosmic microwave background, in particular via the delta resonance, and lose energy by production of ions. And what Greisen, Zazepin, and Kusmin predicted that this would lead to a suppression of the flux at the highest energies, because particles at even higher energies don't travel through the whole universe. The energy loss length for this process is something like 20 megaparsecs. So that was a theoretical prediction at the time. Expect the suppression of the flux above these energies, unless the sources are very close. If the sources are within this GZK horizon, even particles at higher energies could reach us. Now, this example here is for primary proton, but also if you take nuclei, they would photo disintegrate these energies and lose the energy quite efficiently. The typical energy loss in such a process is 20% that the proton is losing. Pions are produced, and the neutral pions very quickly decay into 2 photons. These are so-called GZK photons. While the charged pions finally decays also into neutrinos. So the photons typically carry something like 10% of the initial proton energy, and the free neutrinos something like 5% of the initial proton energy. And what one can also do is to search for these secondary particles from this GZK process, the GZK photons and neutrinos. These are GZK messenger particles. They would indicate that this process is indeed happening. Now, this flux suppression is also a good thing, because the flux from very distant sources at the highest energies is suppressed. Particles of very high energy do not reach us from very far away, only from very close sources. And this might allow us to search for directional correlation to close sources, Otherwise, the flux from the very distant sources would completely overlay with the closed sources. So this might open, thanks to the detailed pay process, also the possibility to do astronomy with cosmic rays at highest energy. So that was in 66, the prediction of a flux suppression. 25 years later, in 91, an event was observed with an enormous energy, the world record still until today, of 300 eV, 3 × 10⁻²⁰ electron volts. So with an energy clearly above the GZK threshold, an enormous energy compared with 10⁻³⁰ for the LHC protons. One tried to look in the direction of that air shower or cosmic ray, but did not see any obvious correlation to an astrophysical source. And here the event is shown, this we call the longitudinal profile, number of particles in units of billion, as a function of atmospheric depth, so here's top of atmosphere, and here the shower was hitting ground. Number of particles is increasing, reaches something like 250 billion particles in the shower maximum, and then the shower is dying out again and fading away. So this was above the GZK energy, and the question was, is there now a flux suppression as predicted by GZK or not? And the situation in 2004 was unclear. What is shown here is the flux of cosmic rays measured at the time 2004. It's scaled by EQ, so that structures are better visible in this flux spectrum. And there was one experiment, a ground array of 200 square kilometers compared to Lindsay, 2 square kilometers, so a factor of 50 larger. The answer of that experiment was no, we did not observe the suppression of the flux. While this experiment here, that was using the fluorescence telescope technique, said yes, we do observe the flux suppression. So there was an experimental problem at that time, and the problem actually was twofold. First, not enough statistics. If you look at the error bars here, that is due to statistics. Very few events at very high energies, and for that reason, one needs to go to larger and larger areas here. But in addition, there seems to be some systematic problems. These experiments were using two different experimental techniques, so that might also be a problem due to systematics. So what is needed is actually to resolve it to something bigger, and ideally something that combines both experimental techniques. Okay, a quick reminder or comment about the theory status back in 2004. Simply speaking, there were two classes of models, one called the bottom-up models, where particles are accelerated from small energy up to highest energy. And this is connected to astrophysical sources like active galactic nuclei, gamma ray bursts, and so on. But at the time, and also still through until today, it is not easy to explain efficient particle acceleration up to these enormous energies of 10⁻²⁰ electron volts. This is still sort of a puzzle. And looking at the arrival direction, it seems surprisingly isotropic, the arrival directions. One would expect maybe some directional correlation to these astrophysical objects, but there was nothing obvious. And let's us note at that time, mostly protons were discussed as the type of a primary particle. Heavier nuclei were not really discussed so much. And the second class were top-down models. This is something exotic connected to particle physics, like super heavy dark matter or mantillas and so on. These are hypothetical, very massive objects that decay and immediately produce the energy of the cosmic rays, the ultra-high energy. So there you avoid the problem to explain particle acceleration. But this is truly a speculation. Well, there is at least one way to distinguish between these two categories, and that's the predicted fraction of ultra-high energy photons. In the bottom-up models, the GZK photons are produced, but only at a very small level, below 1% or so. while when these objects decay, they produce many pions, and the neutral pions decay into photons. So where the fraction of alpha energy photons was predicted to be very large, larger than 10% at various energies. So that would be a smoking gun observation. Okay, let's summarize so far. To do, we need something big and bold. This brings us to Roger Observatory. And some of the questions, is there a flux suppression at various energies? Do we have large photon fluxes as predicted by the top-down models? Or more general, what is the type of a primary particle? Is it protons, as most theorists expected? Is there any directional correlation? And also, what can we perhaps do for particle or fundamental physics with these particles? So let me introduce the PRJ collaboration. By now, we have a total of about 500 scientists from 19 countries all over the world. And OJ was initiated by Jim Conin from Chicago and Al Watson from Leeds. The experiment is located in Argentina, close to the Andes. And here you see the layout of a detector. This is located in the Pampa Amarilla in the province of Mendoza in Argentina. And there's a small city, maybe 10,000 people living here in the city of Malargue. Each of these dots is one detector station, a water Cherenkov station. You will see a picture in a minute. And they have a distance of 1.5 kilometers to each other. So overall, this covers an area of 3,000 square kilometers. You also have the scale 50 kilometers. Now, this is the ground array. And in addition, we have fluorescence telescopes in four stations at the border of the array, 1, 2, 3, and 4. In each of these stations, six fluorescence telescopes, which observe the atmosphere above this ground array in clear moonless nights. The building started in about 2000. More serious physics data we have since 2004, and it was finished well at the end of 2008. Here you see some pictures. So, this is one of these water Cherenkov stations located in the Pampa. The Pampa is at an altitude of 1,400 meters above sea level. In the background, you see the Andes Mountains, which reach 4,000, 5,000 meters in this area. Here, another of these ground array detectors, and in the background, you see one of these telescope stations. So in the night, the shutters open, and the telescopes observe the atmosphere above this ground array. And here you see a photograph of this telescope, about 12 square meter area. And this is a camera of 40 multipliers, a matrix of 440 photo multipliers, which are observing this mirror.
Sorry to interrupt, I just got an email that your microphone is not on.
It's not on. Should I start from the beginning? Okay. So here you see some pictures how these water tanks are being prepared. This is in the city of Malargue, next to our area. So you see here they are prepared in the hall and wait for the transport into the Pampa, which is done here, four in a row on a truck and then brought out. Here, this is not a van that is carrying milk, but it is carrying highly purified water. This is what we need because these detectors are supposed to operate for 10 or 15 years. So we do not need biological activity in this thing. So we need very highly purified water for that. Now you might think that putting water into the Pampa is somewhat crazy because there's no water in the Pampa at all. This is often true, but not always, as you can see here. So it sometimes can be quite an adventure to do this sort of installation. And by the way, you also see two workers and three supervisors.
Now, after successful installation, where's the quality checked by the usual inhabitants of the Pampa? And this is a cover of a French journal where this nice photograph was taken. It is Gaucho country, so you see a real Gaucho here. Here's the dog. But if you look very closely, you see that the Gaucho is phoning with his cellular phone. So also technical advancements there. Here you can test your eyes. This is an aerial view over the Pampa. This is one detector, 1.5 kilometers to the next water tank, again 1.5 kilometers, and here's the fourth one. Nope. So this is how it looks like, and it's nice. It's a large, very flat area where you can put these type of detectors. Okay, so we measure the air showers with two techniques. The first one, with a water Cherenkov tanks, we measure the particles arriving on ground. They are flying through the tank and produce Cherenkov light, which we register. This detector is working 24/7, so always day and night. While the second type is not working always, with the second type, we observe the fluorescence light when this air shower is created and flying through the atmosphere. In particular, nitrogen molecules are excited and ionized, and from the excitation, fluorescence light is emitted isotropically. So one can put a telescope also from a distance and looking from the side to the air shower here. But this is only working in very clear moonless nights, so only about 10% of the time. So for 10% of the data, we have a golden data set, so to say. We observe the same air shower with both techniques, which have complementary features. Aha, and from these measurements of the secondary particles, we try to reconstruct what came in. Three things are of interest: the direction, the energy, and the type of a particle. Direction we can reconstruct with about 1 degree of accuracy, energy with about 20% resolution, and we have some sensitivity to the primary type, but this is more of a challenge. Now, somewhat in more detail, how the fluorescence technique is working. Fluorescent light is emitted in certain bands, in lines, mostly between 300 and 400 nanometers. This is registered with our matrix of photomultipliers, which register the signal as a function of the viewing direction of a PMT and as a function of time, 100 nanosecond time resolution. And from the angular time correlation of a signal in this matrix, we can reconstruct the geometry of the air shower. Once one has the geometry, one takes also the signal strength into account and can reconstruct the longitudinal profile of the air shower. This is practically the energy deposit on the shower axis as a function of the atmospheric depth of the air shower. And this is a very nice thing if one can observe this, because the EDX as a function of X, if you integrate this, so basically the area below this curve is a measure of the primary energy of a particle. So this is a calorimetric measurement technique. So you integrate that, you have to do a small correction for what we call the missing energy. That's the energy that is going into neutrinos or very high energy muons that we do not observe by this fluorescence light, but that's about a 10% correction. So largely it's just the area below this curve. And another important thing is the position where the shower reaches the maximum signal, the maximum energy deposit, X max, this is called, because this X max, depth of shower maximum, is connected to the type of a primary particle. And this we will also exploit later. Now the ground array, here you see an example of a shower that triggered several detectors. From the timing of the triggered tanks, one can reconstruct the geometry from triangulation. That's fairly straightforward. Once the geometry is reconstructed, one can plot the signal measured in a detector as a function of a distance between the detector and the center of the air shower, the impact point. That is the lateral distribution of a shower signal. And then one can extract, for instance, the signal at a 1,000 meter distance and use this as an estimator for the primary energy of a particle. Now, looking more closely into the signal as a function of time in the detector, it may look like this. And there is some sensitivity, again, to the type of a primary particle by looking at the details, how this signal looks like. Okay, so let's come to some results of the Auger Observatory. To remind us some question, is there a flux suppression at highest energies? Are there large photon fluxes? What about directional correlation and particle or fundamental physics? Let us start with photon fluxes. Then the question is, how do we separate air showers initiated by primary photons from those initiated by primary hadrons, proton or iron nuclei or so? And where this quantity of depth of shower maximum, X max, for instance, is important. What is shown here are results from Monte Carlo simulations, where we simulate these air showers in great detail. Number of particles as a function of atmospheric depth. And this is all for particles of 10 to 20 electron volts here. This is primary photons. And we see that primary photon air showers penetrate deeper into the atmosphere than primary hadron showers. So the value of X max is larger for these sort of showers. Also, if you compare primary proton to primary iron shower, you see that protons penetrate deeper than the more heavier nuclei of primary iron, which interact earlier in the atmosphere. Okay, so this is a specific prediction or expectation from simulations. Photon showers should have very deep X max. So we go to the data and look if we indeed observe air showers with such deep X max values. And this is not the case. So from the non-observation of these sorts of air showers, we can derive an upper limit to the flux of photons in the cosmic rays. That is shown here, photon flux as a function of energy, integral photon flux to be precise. These were the upper limits from Auger data, and this can be compared to the previous predictions by top-down models, which are these lines, and they are a factor of 3 or even an order of magnitude larger than our upper limits to the photons. So this means we do not observe so many photons, and top-down models, generically the class of top-down models, are very strongly constrained by these upper limits. This does not mean that they are completely ruled out, but at least it's fair to say they are very strongly constrained. This later on was independently confirmed by neutrino limits because these top-down models also predicted large neutrino fluxes, which were not observed. We still continue to search for photons at ultra-high energy. Remember, photons were GZK messengers. But those fluxes are at much smaller level. Here you see one line. This is in most optimistic scenarios for these bottom-up models, the flux level that you would expect. But it can easily be one or two orders of magnitude smaller, depending on several parameters that go into these calculations. Okay, second question is, where a flux suppression at high energy, how do we calibrate our detector? Well, that is the first step. We use these 10% of the data set where we have measurements with both detector types to calibrate that. The energy can be deduced from the fluorescence telescope that is shown here. And this is a quantity, the signal at 1,000 meter distance, normalized to a zenith angle of 38 degrees from the ground array, which is working full time. So by this curve, we calibrate the ground array signal with the energy from the fluorescence telescope. With this calibration curve, this is then applied to the full data set of the ground array, to the full 100% of data. And with this, we can then reconstruct the primary energy spectrum that is shown here, again multiplied by E cube as a function of energy. And what we see here, indeed, there is a flux suppression at highest energies at about 4 times 10 to 19 electron volt in the current energy scale. The flux is going down and not just continuing, if one would extrapolate that. This flux suppression is consistent with expectation for a GZK-type flux suppression. But we cannot yet be totally sure that this is indeed due to a GZK process. An alternative possibility is that the sources like AGNs are running out of power. This might be some coincidence, but still we cannot totally be sure that this is the GZK process. And I would like to draw your attention to another feature also, which was observed here at energies of 3 times 10 to 18 electron volt. There's a kink in the spectrum, so the spectral slope is increasing again. That is called the angle. And the origin is also not yet totally clear of that feature. Is there a directional correlation? We search for that with regard to nearby extragalactic matter, like nearby AGNs. This was a process of 2 steps. At first, we fixed certain parameters with very early data. We fixed parameters like the minimum energy threshold of our air showers. So we only regarded the highest energy air showers above 55 eV. Or the distance to the AGNs, the maximum distance. We then only regard active galactic nuclei below 75 megaparsecs. And the angular radius around an AGN, where we would say if an air shower was from that direction, then it would be a correlation and it would match, or otherwise it would not match. And where 3.1 degree was chosen. This was fixed with early data. And then we waited for new data where with this prescription we tested how many correlations then show up. And that result is shown here on the sky map. So the black points are the highest energy showers above 55 eV. And these blue circles or ellipses due to the projection are the nearby active galactic nuclei with a radius of 3.1 degree around it. And then one can count. This one, for instance, is not correlating. The black point is not above the blue one. This one is correlating. Here are many correlating and so on. And the updated number of this from 2011 looks like this. In total, we had 84 air showers above this energy threshold, out of which 28 were matching, were correlating within the prescribed parameters. Of course, also from a random distribution, isotropic flux, you would expect matches, random coincidences, and this would be 17.6 expected, 28 observed. So from this, you can apply then statistics and reject isotropy, random distribution at a 99% confidence level. Now, this is already something, and it would be very important if this could be confirmed. Would be for the first time that from directions one can look with cosmic rays to the sources. But 99% is not yet really enough. It is not really a large confidence. So we need to wait for more data so that this confidence level is increasing to a larger number. Now, related to that, if you look into this region here, there might be some overdensity of air showers coming from that direction. And that's actually the direction of the closest AGN, the most nearby active galactic nuclei, Centaurus A. That is at a distance of 4 megaparsec to us. And what is shown here is the cumulative event distribution as a function of a space angle difference with regard to Centaurus A. So you draw a circle around Centaurus A and count how many events are within this circle from the direction towards Centaurus A. And the maximum difference towards the expectation for an isotropic distribution of a flux is at a circle at a radius of 18 degree, where we observe 13 events from that part of the sky, while on average 3.2 would be expected from isotropy. But the caveat here is that this analysis is a posteriori, so we scanned over it and looked where the maximum deviation is, but we did not do beforehand a prescription, so one cannot really attach a statistical significance to this. But for sure, it is something interesting to keep in mind and monitor if indeed from this part of the sky, maybe from the closest AGN, a larger flux of cosmic rays at highest energies is coming to us. What about the type of a primary particle? We have seen it's not photons. Then what else is it? That is shown here. This is the quantity of depth of shower maximum we have seen before, and this is the average depth of shower maximum in a certain energy bin as a function of a primary energy. And let us at first look at the data only, so the black points. Then you see here that at first there is some slope, and at an energy of about 2 or 3 × 10⁻¹⁸ electron volt, the slope is changing. So at this energy, there is some break in the slope. Similar in the plot here at the bottom, this is the RMS, the width of a distribution of X max. This was the mean, this is the width. And there also at energies of 2 to 3 × 10⁻¹⁸ electron volts, there seems to be some change, while until here it's maybe constant. The width of a distribution is going down. And this energy, 2 to 3 × 10⁻¹⁸, that was also the energy where we observe the angle in the flux spectrum, in the energy spectrum, where we observe this change of a spectral slope. So it seems that at this energy, something is going on. Now, to be more quantitative, what kind of primary particle, you need to compare your measurements with simulations for primary protons or primary photons. These are the lines that are shown here, for instance. But where you see one problem, for doing these simulations, we have to extrapolate hadronic interactions up to the highest energies, well beyond the region where accelerators are doing their measurements. And also kinematically in the forward region, because that's most essential for air showers, while it's not so important for accelerators. Okay, and you see here, these are different models. There's quite some spread in the expected X max values for primary protons, for instance. This is for primary iron. If one wants to take this then more seriously, one would say maybe at these energies, the composition is more light, perhaps almost pure proton, but at least some lighter composition. While going to higher energy, there seems to be some trend towards a more heavier composition. Maybe a mixed composition, or maybe some intermediate nuclei like nitrogen or oxygen or so. And in particular, looking at the RMS, so the width of a distribution in a certain energy bin, here it looks still more light, perhaps protons, but going to higher energy, there's a tendency towards heavier nuclei. And this was surely a surprise. As I mentioned before, it was mostly protons that had been regarded by theorists. But here, if one takes the simulation line seriously, it does not really look like pure protons. The pure proton assumption would be disfavored. A way to save a pure proton assumption would be to say all of these extrapolated lines, the simulations are wrong, because there is something drastically new going on in the interactions at highest energy. But, well, this is unclear. This might be more speculation, but cannot be excluded. Okay, let's do a quick summary from the what we have done so far, from the photon limits. We see top-down models are disfavored. It does not mean that bottom-up models are necessarily right, but surely they are favored at present to explain the origin of cosmic rays. We observe a flux suppression at highest energy consistent with GZK, but not really clear. We cannot really exclude that also this shows us simply the maximum energy of the sources. Directional correlation only at the highest energy. Below that energy, cosmic rays arrive surprisingly isotropic. And at highest energy, only at a 99% confidence level, we would like to see larger confidence levels here to be really sure. If confirmed, this would indicate sources are extragalactic. Which ones exactly? Not yet sure. Centaurus A could be a good nearby candidate. And if confirmed, it would indicate that cosmic rays have a fairly small electric charge and or that magnetic fields are fairly small, because with heavier nuclei, large magnetic fields, the angles would be much more deflected from cosmic rays and you would not expect to see a directional correlation. Particle type, in particular from the fairly small width of the X-max distribution at highest energy, it seems to be more heavier nuclei, intermediate nuclei, or mixed composition, or as an alternative, a very drastic change in hadronic interaction features. And there's an angle showing up in the flux spectrum at 3 × 10⁻¹⁸ electron volt, also at a similar energy, perhaps some change in the composition of a cosmic rays. That is also not yet totally clear where this is coming from. One idea is this is the transition from galactic cosmic rays to extragalactic cosmic rays, which could explain such a thing, or from a propagation feature from pure extragalactic protons, they could also produce such a dip, but this would be in some tension with interpretation here. So we have important data input from the Auger Observatory, but no simple picture, no standard model of ultra-energy cosmic rays emerging yet. Okay, two more things on particle physics. We were able to determine the cross-section, proton-proton cross-section at 2 × 10⁻¹⁸ electron volts or 57 TeV in center of mass by using the X-max distribution. This is shown here, the distribution of the observed depth of shower maximum, logarithmic plot. And then you see here the exponential fall off in the distribution. And this is connected to the point where the first interaction took place of the air shower. The point where the first interaction takes place is connected to the cross section. Therefore, this gives you a sensitivity to the cross section. From this, you determine at first the proton air cross section that is shown here, that is the Auger result at 2 × 10⁻¹⁸ electron volt, compared with some previous measurements also from air showers. And applying Glauber transformation, you can transform from proton air, proton nucleus, to proton proton. That is shown here, and when you can compare the Auger result also to results from the LHC experiments. And there were some speculations before that this cross-section might rise very steeply towards high energy, but we do not see an indication for such a strong rise. Now, we do see an indication for too few muons in the simulation. I will be very brief on that. This is the longitudinal profile. If you simulate for primary proton or iron to reproduce the observed longitudinal profiles with the telescopes, then you can compare what ground distribution, lateral distribution of the particles do the simulation predict and compare that to the measured ones. And when you see the simulated signal on ground is too small, and this is being attached to the muons in the air showers, it seems there are too few muons in the simulation. The reason for that is not yet really understood. Okay, let me then come to some fundamental physics or tests of Lorentz violation. I say right away from a non-theorist, I'm not a theorist and I'm not in the quantum gravity community. And this is also not from Auger. These are not Auger papers that I will show these two examples. The first test, possible test of the violation of Lorentz transformation is the following. The idea is check for an accumulation of GZK photons. So this would be a category, check for the absence of a standard interaction, an interaction that in standard physics you would expect. Thank you. And now check if due to violation of Lorentz invariance, this process is absent. So what is it? In standard physics, we said GZK photons have a fairly small flux level, perhaps 0.1% of a cosmic ray flux. And this is because once they are produced by the GZK process, they interact fairly quickly with low energy photons and make pair production. And this way, they initiate an electromagnetic cascade, but they disappear. Well, therefore, the flux is so small. Now, if Lorentz transformation is not okay, at this extreme range, and we have here a very high energy photon, 10 to 19 electron volts, with a very low energy photon, 10 to minus, I don't know, 4 electron volt or so. If this would be violated, then GZK photons would not disappear, but they would accumulate, and the flux would accumulate. And then larger fractions are possible than these 0.1% expected from standard physics. More quantitatively, this has been investigated by Galavani and Siegel in this work. This is the photon fraction as a function of energy. This is the flux level expected if Lorentz transformation is okay, 0.1%. If you switch this process off, then photons accumulate and you would expect something like 20% of a cosmic ray flux to be photons. This is not what we observe. We have a photon limit from Auger, like 2% at this energy. So such a scenario can be excluded. One question, yeah.
So your photon determination is determined by depth of penetration, right? And this is a kinematic change. Okay. So my question is, how sensitive is that depth measurement to the actual kinematics of their reactions as they penetrate, or is it basically just sort of cross-section? Kind of, you know, and in there that determining factor is actually invariant to this type of kinematic change.
Okay, so you are asking how well do we understand the photon simulation in standard physics? Yeah?
Exactly. I'm asking, does this type of kinematic change actually also change the determination method for saying that they are photons?
Okay, yeah. That's a good question. My understanding when speaking with Günther Siegel is that it does not do. That it does not do. That we still would expect photons to penetrate very deeply into the atmosphere.
Actually, that has been checked.
Yeah, okay.
There was at least we look at that with our algorithm, for example.
You did?
Yeah,
okay.
And also we discussed that with
Siegel. Is it cross-section? Is the cross-section the determining factor? Is it a...
You mean why is this not insensitive?
Yeah, sorry, I'll ask you.
Yeah, it's basically, I think you're right, but basically the simulation with the outcome was that it was strongly sensitive. It wasn't strongly sensitive to this modification, so the determination of the flux is still alive.
Well, but it's right, one must be self-consistent in that. And another caveat actually to this is, the assumption here is that there are GZK photons at all. And for this to have, you need to have nucleons above a GZK energy scale, above 5 or 6 × 10⁻¹⁹ electron volts, which might well be possible, but we cannot yet be sure of that. Right? Well, anyway, from these non-large photon fluxes, at least one can say we have no indication for the violation of Lorentz invariance. And the second example is the following. This example, the previous one, was absence of a standard interaction. There's a question.
If I understand correctly, the slide, you could not have any. The slide doesn't help. You only have upper bounds, so you could not have any evidence of it. With upper bounds, since the effect is the effect that Galavani and Siegel studied would increase the thing, so you don't have evidence. With upper bounds, if you have a measurement above the expected level of Lorentz transformation, okay, then you would have evidence of the effect. But with upper bounds, the only thing you can do is exclude models. Do I understand
yes.
correctly?
Yes, I would say so. They have a specific model in this model, which breaks Lorentz invariance here. You would expect 20% of a cosmic rays to be photons.
Well, there must be a parameter in that model for sure.
There are surely certain assumptions in this model. I don't know how generically this is. Maybe you know, Stefano.
If I can comment, that paper wasn't basically done neither in effective field theory. That model is not the kind of dispersion relation you get in effective field theory, neither what you get with arguments about deformation and so on. So it was a simplified model. So if you got it with the effective field theory, actually the result changed, but not too much. It's still incompatible with what you still would see a flux that should have been seen. However, it heavily relies on the assumption that what you're seeing is the GZK.
Right.
Because if you have that there are any ions instead of protons, then photon disintegration doesn't lead to the same flux, and basically I mean, this uncertainty is enough to make this constraint weak. I mean,
yep. Okay, thank you. Now, that was a test of a logic. Oh, but please, this was discussion. That was of a category absence of a standard interaction. This is now the category presence of a non-standard interaction. And the idea is that the mere existence of cosmic rays at highest energies might be able to provide you with constraints of Lorentz violation. So the idea is take a Lorentz violating theory, then new interactions appear, which would lead to a rapid energy loss above a certain energy threshold of a particle. Now, in turn, we do observe particles with a certain very high energy. This would then allow you to conclude that the energy threshold for this new interaction must be above the energy of this particle. And this would allow you to constrain Lorentz violating parameters. And a specific case is, for the theory, this would be modified Maxwell theory, where you end up with 9 non-birefringent Lorentz-violating parameters. The new process would be vacuum Cherenkov radiation of protons, where photons are emitted. We observe particles at 10 to 20 electron volts. So this then allows you to put constraints, and for instance, 1 out of these 9 parameters is an isotropic one, the other are anisotropic. But for the example of this 1 isotropic, this is a dimensionless quantity, the constraint is very strong, of the order a few times 10 to 19 electron volts. Roughly where this energy, upper limit is coming from, the energy threshold is basically determined by the mass of a primary, divided by the square root of some scale made out of these parameters, these Lorentz violating parameters. If you resolve for kappa, then the limit is given by the ratio of a mass of a primary divided by energy to the square. And if you put a fairly heavy nucleus like iron, this is something like 50 GeV mass of a nucleus, divided by 10 to 20 electron volt to the square, when you have this order of magnitude limits. So the key in this is the very large energy, the extreme energy that these ultra energy cosmic rays are having. This is the lever arm which pushes this to so small values. Well, obviously we observe ultra energy cosmic rays at this extreme energy. So they do reach us. Again, we do not see an indication for the violation of Lorentz invariance. Stefano?
Here you are considering the proton superluminal and the photon unmodified. Because, of course, the formulas depend on both the dispersion relation of the proton and the photon. So, in order to have vacuum Cherenkov, for example, a given situation, you have to assume that the proton is superluminal, that means it goes faster than the low energy speed of light at high energy, and the gamma, from your formula, I guess you are taking an unmodified gamma. Because there is also only a factor of Lorentz violation.
In the SMB, a quick Kappa parameter actually refers to the photon.
So you are modifying the photon subluminal and the proton is unmodified.
My understanding.
What are the dispersion relation, basically, I'm asking?
Yeah. I'm not a theorist. I can show you the paper. My understanding is that the photon speed is modified. And as you say, the photon velocity is smaller than the proton one. And for that reason, the proton is stopped below this energy threshold.
In a definitive way, basically.
Yes, it is predicted in a definite way. This is with modified Maxwell theory. As Dave said, this is with SME extension and formalism that I'm not an expert of. So there's a well-defined theory
the standard model extension
behind
all the Lorentz breaking term, so it's not that you a priori have a sign subluminal, superluminal, or something. I mean, you just have.
I think it's both sided.
Special relation with a different limit speed, you know.
Because of the SME, the dispersion modification is not energy dependent.
That's the minimum then.
The MSME, right? Then the very low energy proton stuff constrains that sector much more tightly.
Okay, so you just consider the constraint on the minimal standard model extension. So they just a different limit speed, and you are basically modifying only the photon. basically you are considering that there is a difference in limit speed between the proton and the photon, so that
it is a limit in the photon sector.
The photon is lower than the proton. Then.
Yeah, it's a limit on the photon sector. Right.
Yeah, we have to be careful when you give this constraint, because there are, for example, I mean, it's already much, very much constrained, the minima stars, standard model extension, but the same things, you know, when you go to, Max, Mayer's postulate of, standard model extension, where you have dimension 5 operator, you have a much more complicated situation, because you can have, subluminal photons or superluminal proton. I mean, you can have you have to analyze your parameter space, and there are regions where the Cherenkov constraint apply and regions where it doesn't. So it's...
This is the same here, right?
Well, apparently it's claiming that you have a situation where the photon is always subluminal with respect to the proton.
No, this is a one-sided bound.
Yes, of course it's one-sided bound, but I wonder...
Maybe we can shift the rest of the
discussion.
Because we have 0 minutes.
0 minutes, okay. So anyway, the message here is they do reach us, and this is maybe one of the key points. We have particles at these ridiculous energies, 10 to 20 electron volts, which travel distances, astronomical distances over many megaparsecs and come to us. They have much time or space to do many sorts of funny interactions, but still they do reach us. So this is the basic idea. Test the presence of non-standard interactions, they do reach us, and this may give constraints. Just to mention, we do not yet observe photons at highest energies, but once we do, I understand that this would also be interesting for constraining Lorentz violation. Now, this would be 4 or 5 orders of magnitude larger in energy compared to what we have, because this would test the absence of a photon decay. Okay, there is, back to Auger, there is much work going on concerning upgrades to do better measurements to lower energy, like putting detectors at smaller distances, telescopes that are looking more upward into the atmosphere. All this building can be moved, looking upward and downward again. Installing detectors that look dedicatedly to muons in the air showers, and trying new techniques like radio or microwave detection of air showers. And also beyond Auger, there is activity going on. Earlier this year, we had a joint symposium of the full ultra energy community, the different experiments and theorists to prepare for a next generation ground-based giant detector, and these activities is going on for the timeline after Auger. Now my timeline is over, so let me conclude here. Since 2004, we have high quality and quantity data from Auger. These have changed the intellectual landscape at ultra energy, but there is no standard model of ultra energies yet emerging. There are still lots of interesting questions. Much work is still going on at Auger and beyond. So my conclusion, even after 100 years, the field is active and attractive. Thank you.